case of Jeffrey Harvey versus David Flockhart. And Ms. James, do you need any rebuttal time?
3 minutes, Your Honor.
Certainly.
Good morning. May it please the court.
I'm Give Shelley. Me 1 second
oh,
to use our fancy state-provided timers.
Yes.
Thank you. We're ready when you are.
My name is Shelley James, and I'm here representing the Harveys in this appeal of an adoption and denial of the continuance of visitation case. I want to start by thanking Your Honors for agreeing to move this to the beginning of the docket. I have a case back in Harrisonburg this afternoon that needed to stay where it was, so I greatly appreciate it, and I appreciate opposing counsel's agreement to that also. This case, we've raised 5 issues. All of them are important. Many of them are things that can have far-reaching effects outside of this particular adoption. I'm just going to go through them in order, unless Your Honors want to start someplace in particular. The first issue that we raise is jurisdiction that the court had over visitation. I think it is agreed that the visitation order was not properly appealed out of the JDR court. It was not noted within 10 days. I think we all agree on that at this point.
The adoption case was properly before the circuit court, right, based
yes.
on the petition?
Yes.
And so doesn't the resolution of that matter then foreclose visitation for grandparents?
Well, Your Honor, that would be an issue to argue, perhaps, but I think if the only thing that's before the court at that point is an adoption, then the court should not be commenting, the circuit court should not be commenting on whether or not the visitation continues or not. That would seem to be an advisory opinion in that case. In addition, there are no pleadings outside of the alleged appeal from the visitation order from the JDR court that put the matter before the court. And while Ms. Ashby relies on 16.1-244 to say that the circuit court had jurisdiction, first of all, that's not a statute that addresses circuit courts. That's a statute that addresses JDR courts.
Doesn't it address concurrent jurisdiction there?
It does, Your Honor. So if
the jurisdiction be concurrent with circuit?
Right. So if the circuit court had acquired jurisdiction in some way, the fact that the juvenile court had jurisdiction wouldn't have foreclosed the circuit court from considering the issue. But this particular statute doesn't say that the circuit court has jurisdiction over any concurrent issue, no matter what the pleadings say. I believe it was Judge McCullough who wrote a very interesting opinion as far as the divorce bar is concerned about if it's not in the pleadings and the pleading gets dismissed, then you can't award spousal support. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name of the case. But in this case, there are no pleadings that put this before the circuit court. There is no jurisdiction for the court to consider that issue. It wasn't appealed from the juvenile court. There are no pleadings that make it an issue. And this particular statute, while it says that the circuit court's jurisdiction is not foreclosed, it does not grant the circuit court jurisdiction. It just says that if they have jurisdiction, it is concurrent and they can take it even if the JDR court has it too. For the court to weigh in on this issue is, in this case, at best an advisory opinion and should not have been taken up by the court. We did go ahead and address it because the court said it was within their jurisdiction, but that was done simply because the court made a ruling, and so we went forward with that ruling. In addition, in the brief, I discuss why the right result, wrong reason won't apply here. There are some additional factual findings that the circuit court would have had to have made if this was the reason they're going to address, and I will leave that to Your Honors to consider. What this court should do is void that part of the order, or void that particular order in this case, and allow my client's visitation with these children to continue. As far as the continuance is concerned, There was an original home study that was filed a little late in the proceedings, but it did get filed, and it is actually on page 405, and I'm sorry, we had some problems with the appendix, numerous problems with the appendix in this case, and I did not check every single page number, apparently, but it is on page 405 in the appendix, which I believe is the short sealed appendix, that the home study is actually presented. And it talks about how there are separate bedrooms for the boys and the girls and a separate bedroom for the Flockharts in the basement, that it was renovated in 2004, that there's a fire escape plan, that it's free of any safety hazards. The home got a clean bill of health. And then about a week, maybe less, before trial, we got an addendum that completely changed everything. These bedrooms were not bedrooms. No one should have been sleeping in this basement. In addition, there were other hazards outside the home that the fire marshal found.
But isn't that a kind of technical? I mean, it's one thing to have zoning laws and whatever. But, you know, if I want to sleep in my furnished basement and what, I mean, does that really matter that it's not a bedroom?
Well, Your Honor, it does matter because in this case in particular, it meant that there can be a particular safety hazard. There's no egress.
There's no door at all in the basement to the outside.
That's our understanding, Your Honor. My clients are banned from that property. I've never been to that property, and we weren't given an opportunity to see if we could get somebody else out there. There is some paperwork that was filed to have a motion to reconsider. We were able to find some things after the trial date that talked about how these problems still have not been fixed.
Well, excuse me, counsel, the addendum to the home study, was that before the trial judge?
It was.
So the trial judge was aware of the IFC.
Yes, and that was the explicit reason for the continuance, was that had been filed late. It put into question things in the home study. Quite honestly, it put into question the credibility of the person who did the home study. And there was no reason to question that home study beforehand or that person's credibility.
Can I ask this about the home? There are notations that we've seen of three bedrooms. Mm-hmm. Are those three bedrooms upstairs? They're not in the basement.
There are three bedrooms upstairs. There were grandparents and great-grandparents that were living upstairs. And then, according to the addendum, everybody moved upstairs, which included the Flockharts, I guess. At least all of the children moved upstairs. And there are more children in this family than the two that are up for adoption.
There are five children.
Yes. And the addendum says that the boys had one bedroom, the girls had another bedroom. So I don't know where the two couples are sleeping.
If there are three couples, right?
Well, yeah, three couples if the Flockharts are also sleeping upstairs. You know, what is going on in this household? And then the addendum says there's still plenty of room for everybody. It just doesn't make any sense.
So the three bedrooms are upstairs or above the basement, mm-hmm. and they're in the basement. There was discussion of three bedrooms there as well.
Yes.
But they are not actually bedrooms.
Correct.
Are there windows in the basement as well? Is there any ingress or egress?
It was my impression that there might be a small window, where the basement has some space above the ground level. But quite honestly, I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Well, what is the difference between having a bedroom upstairs where if there's a fire or whatever, you have to run downstairs and leave, or there's the basement where you have to run upstairs to leave?
Well, the first issue is actually the windows, and that's part of what the fire code and safety regulations talk about, is there needs to be a way to get out. At least if you're upstairs in something that is a bedroom, there is a window, and you might have to drop a floor, but you can at least get out. There's more than one way.
I mean, I don't know.
I'm sorry?
If you're a toddler or a young child, I don't think that's really
That may be the case, Your Honor, but this is something that we weren't able to get into before the trial because we weren't aware that these issues even existed. But there are the safety regulations. It was also noted in what my clients were able to find out was that these changes to the home that were allegedly made in 2004, there had never been any building permits for those. And though the addendum said that the Flockharts had been working diligently on getting any permits, there still weren't any permits after the date of this trial. We don't know that there are any permits to date. So we don't even know that the construction in the basement, if it is sound or not. We don't know if the electrical work in the basement is sound or not. It says that there was a fire safety plan that usually includes, if it's on the second floor, some ladders you can throw out the windows. They couldn't do that because if there were windows, you couldn't crawl out them. That was part of the problem in this case.
Ask you on another subject. The trial judge, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the trial judge seemed to find, and I would think this would be a finding of fact, that appellants here have considerable difficulty recognizing the Flockharts as parents of the children,
mm-hmm.
or as foster parents, or as parents if they are successful in adopting them. If that's a factual finding of the trial court, how is the trial court's ultimate conclusion in this case something that we as an appellate court should reverse if that relationship is one where they can't accept the Flockharts as parents?
There are two issues there, Your Honor. The evidence that the judge is basing that opinion on and how that would affect the best interests of the children. I'll take them in reverse. The best interests of the children, just because these two families do not get along. That happens in all sorts of families. That does not necessarily lead directly to the conclusion that the Harveys should be taken out of these children's lives. Just because they can't agree, I mean, parents all the time can't agree, can't recognize that the other parent is actually a parent to the child. And as long as they can each provide support and care and love to these children, my clients who had a court order giving them visitation should be allowed to continue that visitation. In addition, we believe that that opinion is based on faulty evidence in this case. In particular, the home study, which the addendum proves was not completely done and creates credibility issues with the home study. And in addition, Don Walsh, who testified as the expert for the Flockharts, made it very clear during her testimony that her opinion was completely biased. She did not talk to my clients. She knew nothing about my client's history in this case. She didn't even know that there had been a court order giving them visitation or how long they had been involved in the children's care. She saw them generally within a day after they had been to visitation, and supposedly the problem was they were disorganized and so forth. Well, you know, they just spent a weekend.
And just so you're into your rebuttal time at this point.
Your Honor, I would like to speak a little bit about the persons of interest, in part because this is actually an issue that has come up in two cases that I have had, and I think that it is a very important issue. There are now a number of adoptions, a number of terminations, and it is affecting people who have rights independent of the parental rights of the person whose rights have been terminated. In this case, there was a court order entered after the parental rights were terminated. That order had not been appealed, and though the statute 20-142.1 says that a person of legitimate interest would not include persons whose interests are derived from a parent whose rights are terminated, My client's interests derive from the court order. The court had earlier found that my clients had due process rights involved in this adoption. So for the court to then say that they are not persons of interests seems contrary to the evidence in this case.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Kelly Ashby, and I represent the appellees David and Ronalee Flockhart. I'll also address the issues in the order that they were briefed, starting with the issue of jurisdiction over visitation. The procedural posture of this case is unique, and it has been from day one. So we agreed that visitation was incidental to the adoption issue from the beginning, and that is reflected in the fact that the trial court, entered its pretrial order on February 10th of 2014. It identified two issues, the adoption and visitation. Counsel had 10 days to object to the entry of that pretrial order, and no objection was entered or filed by the Harveys. Therefore, they agreed to the issue of visitation being before the court. And the consent order that was entered in the juvenile court was not entered until a month later. So clearly the trial court was not relying solely on the appeal of the juvenile court order in addressing visitation. So to say that the issue of whether the visitation was incidental to the issue of adoption was never addressed by the court is just not accurate, given the timing of the entry of the pretrial order. Judge Athey, the trial court judge, says several times on page 77 of the appendix, it seems to me that the visitation is an issue that this court needs to take into consideration as part of the adoption. Ms. James, I agree, Your Honor. Next page, Judge Athey again saying, everybody knows what the issues are. To some extent, I think everyone knows where everybody stands here, and that is the fact. We all knew that this case was about visitation, which Ms. James confirmed later when she said, this case is not about removing the children.
Where are you reading from, Ms. Ashby? I'm sorry.
The appendix, at this point, I'm on page 83.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Counsel for the appellant said, this case is not about removing the children from the Flockharts. What this case is about is their legal relationship and whether the ultimate step eliminates my clients from their lives, which can only be addressing the issue of visitation. We went through the act of transferring venue, entering a consent order, appealing it, just to be absolutely certain, because this case has been so quirky from the beginning, and it continues to be so. But it wasn't necessary. And in fact, there was some pushback from the juvenile court when an attempt to file a notice of appeal was, what are you appealing from? We didn't do anything. So given the statute 16.1-244, the visitation issue was squarely incidental to the adoption of the children. Obviously, the case cited by counsel in their argument here addressed spousal support, which was not one of the identified incidental issues in the statute regarding concurrent jurisdiction, whereas visitation was. As for the motion for continuance, obviously the standard of review is very high. They have to prove that there was the plainly wrong and that there was prejudice. The addendum that was filed, it's important to remember where that originated from. Our pretrial filings were due 30 days before the trial. On the 29th day before the trial, Ms. Harvey contacted and made a complaint to the building inspectors. So she initiated this review, and then which resulted in an addendum. The issues identified in the addendum are so particular, having to do with something with the pool gate, the grounding of the pool, which Mrs. Flockhart testified. It was ungrounded because it wasn't pool season, so it was unplugged. Pump was unplugged. It would be plugged back in, and it would be properly grounded when the pool was operating. With regard to the sleeping arrangements in the basement, the footprint of the home, it's a ranch, the footprint of the upstairs is identical to the footprint in the basement. The issue with the sleeping areas was there are windows. They were wide enough. They were a little bit short, was the uncontroverted testimony of my client. So the Department
Does
of Social...
Does that mean a little bit short? Could someone climb out if there were a fire?
I'm assuming that's the issue that the building inspectors have, that it was maybe too high from the floor. But that was not...
I guess my question is it wide enough? Not how high it is from the floor, but is it wide enough to climb out of?
It is wide enough. It was not long enough, was my client's testimony.
So you can't get out in a fire. That's my question.
I believe... I'm not an expert in this area, but I believe that the body could fit through widthwise. I just don't know if they could reach the window sill, is my understanding, from the floor.
Is there a door in the basement?
There is not a door to the exterior from the basement. It's not a walkout basement. But the department's job is not to make sure that the house is compliant with code. It's to do so many things. And they did all of those things thoroughly in their inspection, in their report. And remember also that my clients had a fifth child, another half-sibling of the children at issue in this case, placed with them after these two children were placed with them. So the department has been intricately involved with this family, going to their home at least every other month, meeting with them every month, and seeing how everyone was doing. So the department's investigation was thorough. To have missed a few technicalities on length of a window and the functioning of a pool gate is not so important.
Would that go to the weight of the evidence when you look at all the other things?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe so. And the court certainly did not just rely on the department's home study. Took independent evidence and made a determination on its own that the home was a loving and secure place for the children. And keep in mind also that the Harveys are not seeking to take these children from that home. They've agreed that this is a custodial placement. It's just a technicality that they would like to say substantially imperiled justice and should have granted them a continuance, even though they had time to subpoena any person from the Department of Social Services that they wanted after they received the addendum. They received it a week ahead of time. They only needed 5 days. They could have subpoenaed the person who wrote it. They could have subpoenaed the caseworker. They could have subpoenaed anyone. They had the opportunity and did ask questions of my clients with regard to the specifics of the home. So we submit that they just cannot meet their burden of proving abuse of discretion and prejudice by the denial of the motion for continuance. With regard to whether Section 63.2-1229 applies, the statutory foster parent adoption, which we proceeded under, just two quick points. The adoption statute should be liberally construed to carry out the beneficent purposes of the statute. And the court should not add language to any statute. And what the appellants are asking the court to do is read a requirement into that statute that the prospective adoptive parents had to be foster parents at the time the petition was filed. That's not in the statute. What the statute says is the foster parents had children placed with them as foster parents. It's the time of the placement, not the time of the filing of the petition, that the statute is concerned with. And my client certainly satisfied that requirement as the trial court went through and every factor in 63.2-1229 that the social services placed the children with my clients as foster parents. The children had lived with them for almost 2 years, in excess of 18 months. And all the requirements had been satisfied. So there's certainly a statutory mechanism for this adoption to proceed. Quickly, with regard to the best interest, given the standard of review, we submit the Harveys just can't meet their burden to show that it was the best interest of the children for the adoption to be granted. And then the flowing effects of that the visitation would be terminated. The home study, the court heard argument, heard testimony, that shouldn't be a basis for saying the evidence was so faulty that it's clearly erroneous, the finding that it was in the best interest. Also, with regard to the expert witness, the court found...
You a little before you go on to the expert witness.
Absolutely.
Clearly, the best interest of the child is paramount. And on that issue, the trial court in making factual findings is due a considerable amount of deference by an appellate court. Can I ask you, has there ever been concern, and if so, what, of the children's visitation with the Harveys? During any of those visitations, has there ever been concern about their well-being or their interests, their safety?
There have not been concerns for their physical well-being. There has been no allegation that they were being abused or neglected while in the care of the Harveys. The concern is more nuanced than that. It's the emotional well-being of the children, what they're being told, how they feel about being treated differently from their siblings.
Now, how would that be other than that these two who we're talking about today go to see their grandparents, and the other three, they're not their grandparents, so they don't go?
Right, but the whole family's life is structured around this visitation. It's not that the parents say, you know what, you're going to go see your grandparents for a few hours. It's, we have to take you, and you have to stay for this long. And if the kids say they don't want to go, or the parents have something fun planned, it's not optional, as it should be in an intact family.
When there was this built-in tension.
Very interesting.
I mean, unfortunately, they just, and it's not 100% clear to me the reason why, but it's but what is obvious and what emerges loud and clear is they just did not get along. And so then you have this ongoing source of tension that inescapably spills over into the children's lives.
That's exactly it, Your Honor. And I look to cases from outside of Virginia because it just seems intuitive to me that forcing parents, and remember, we're talking about an intact family. This is not a divorce. This is not two parties who have parental rights, and we have to balance that. We don't have to do that here. We're forcing it with the visitation, but we don't have to do that. We can let these kids live in a home where parents agree and are on the same page. But looking at other states, the New Jersey Supreme Court...
Why isn't it in a child's interest to know their grandparents? Because you're essentially, by doing this, you are not only... The parents' rights have been terminated. I understand the biological parents have been terminated. They're legal strangers to their children, and it seems that no one is concerned about that because of the circumstances. But why make the grandparents legal strangers to their children as well?
Well, first of all, that's because that's what the law does, in effect. And
right,
it's not.
The effect here, if there's no visitation, it means no contact, no relationship whatsoever. And if it can work, if there's a way that the adults can get along, having more parents and grandparents loving a child is usually better than less.
That's true. When they're all rowing in the same direction, that is certainly true. And the if that you state is crucial because, as counsel for appellants has pointed out, in initial stages of this case, way back when, there was some hope that the adoptive parents and the biological grandparents could work together and have a supportive relationship for the benefit of the children. But that can't be when the biological grandparents are going to the media and attacking the Department of Social Services and every judge who's touched the case about how wrong this decision was. And when in front of the trial judge, when you would presumably be putting your best foot forward, Mr. Harvey cannot bring himself to say that these parents are good parents. He's so poisoned by the litigation and the lies and the manipulations that he alleges that he would rather a sperm donor be the father of these children than the adoptive father who has invested going on 4 years, more than 4 years at this point, in the lives of these children.
So you think that, just ask you the question I asked Ms. James earlier, that the trial judge here is a very, very good trial judge and a very capable judge. His finding of fact that I asked her about earlier is a key aspect, I gather, from what you're saying in the decision that the Department of Social Services made here.
I believe it was, Judge, because he found that they could not support my clients as the parents of these children. And could not cooperate. And because of them, the parties could not cooperate and resolve disputes regarding the children. And yes, that's the crux. If the relationship were different, we wouldn't be here. And if the relationship could be different in the future, then maybe someday it will be different. But that needs to be at the discretion of the children's parents. And my hope is, and my client's hope is, that when there is finality in this case, that maybe there will be an adjustment in attitude, and the relationship may be able to move forward. But when relationship is forced on the parties, the healing's just not happening. The friction is still there. There are cases in other jurisdictions that I was referencing, West Virginia and New Jersey, where New Jersey Supreme Court found that there was an inherent conflict with grandparent visitation and adoption. And the West Virginia court in In re Hunter stated what I believe our policy to be as well, that the goal of adoption should be finality. And that's what we're seeking, is finality for these children, to be able, that there will be a sever of the old ties, creation of new, to give certainty to the children going forward. It's the children that we're concerned about. If the children, and as I said in my closing statement, I believe very strongly, is the children need to be able to trust their parents to make decisions for what's best for them. And ordering them to allow visitation to people who do not like their parents, who do not support them and believe they are good parents, ordering them to take those children to the Harveys, even if the kids don't want to go, even if the parents don't think it's what's best, undermines the trust that those children can have in their parents going forward and making all the decisions that parents have to make, to assume that the parents know what's best and we need to follow their lead. And in this case, it deprives the parents of that right. So we would ask that the decision of the trial court be affirmed.
Thank you for your argument. Ms. James, you have a little under 3 minutes.
Your Honors, regarding the jurisdictional issue, as you know, the parties cannot agree to grant a court jurisdiction. This is a subject matter jurisdiction issue, and so when Ms. Ashby quotes portions of the record and says that I said things, quite honestly, that doesn't give the court jurisdiction. But in addition, I will say that there is a difference in these quotations. If you look at page 76.
Now, the court had subject matter jurisdiction, right?
Your Honor, that term includes more than just the subject. This court, for example, if there are no pleadings,
okay,
then
but why can't an order that's unobjected to, I mean, the point of a pleading is to place something in issue.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's an order that says, I want you to brief this or address this, even if it's sua sponte from the court, that's not objected to, why doesn't that serve the office of notice, put something in contention, and then go forward?
Quite honestly, Your Honor, those are not considerations when it's a jurisdictional issue. It's not something that the parties can agree to give the court. And Ms. Ashby is correct. We will all operating under the assumption.
Well, are we in the subject matter jurisdiction? Is that the problem? Or is the problem that there wasn't some form of pleading to put something in issue?
As the term subject matter jurisdiction is used, I think those are both. The term subject matter jurisdiction doesn't just refer to, is this a juvenile defendant who shouldn't be in circuit court, for example, or is it an issue that nowhere is
the court
allowed
to consider? It's a statute that confers on a particular court the authority to hear a particular kind of case.
Right, right. Under particular circumstances. And in addition, in this case, we were all operating under the assumption, because we had set it out beforehand, as Ms. Ashby said, that this was going to appeal up, because we thought there were jurisdictional issues, that it needed to be appealed up. That was not properly done. And so I made the objection. And once, and on page 77, I tried to point out to the judge that if it had been properly appealed, I couldn't object to the jurisdiction, whether I did or not, because the court would have had jurisdiction. That's what I was saying on page 77, that even if she had appealed it, I wouldn't have anything to say. But quite honestly, at this point, I had never even gotten any notice of appeal, even the late notice of appeal, which is now in the record.
Counsel, is it your contention then that what Flockharts needed to do was, if the order of adoption was granted, they had to go back and file a motion to terminate visitation in the original juvenile court?
Yes, Your Honor, in the court where it was, with a change of circumstances argument and all the things that are necessary in that. I will also point out where Ms. Ashby points to my argument on page 83. That was after the court had made it clear that it was going to consider visitation, and so that's the way I was going forward to present my case. And so to point out later that I said things that might seem inconsistent with this opinion, the judge told me his ruling, and we were moving forward in the case. And so that is why there might be some inconsistencies there. And earlier, it was because we all assumed that this was going to follow the procedure to give the court jurisdiction, but that procedure was not followed. And it is clear that if a case is not appealed, there is no jurisdiction, and that is void jurisdiction, not voidable. Though in this case, given we made the argument, that's a distinction without a difference, because we preserved the issue. As far
right,
as the
well, you've exhausted your time. If you need to wrap things up, you can have another minute.
I'd just like to say, as far as the continuance is concerned, I think Ms. Ashby illustrated the point that we did need a continuance, where she said that her client testified about the size of the windows and so forth, but we did not have an opportunity to get the building inspector there. We would have needed to have time to find out who the building inspector is. I got a copy of this order, not actually from the court, but from Ms. Ashby on the afternoon of May 20th. Our trial was on May 27th. That is not enough time to investigate additional people, to subpoena from the building inspectors, and to get those subpoenas out so that we could have made this an issue. And then, as far as the best interests and the grandparents being legal strangers, I understand that Ms. Ashby wants to make my clients seem to be the bad guys here, that they're the ones who can't seem to understand that the Flockharts are acting as parents. But you will also note in the record, it is the Flockharts who banned my clients from their property, which is part of the reason they had no clue what was going on in that house. It is the Flockharts who refused gifts to the children and put them in their basement and wouldn't give them to them from my clients. This is not one-sided. The Flockharts have tried out of their
lives. In excess of 5 minutes into your rebuttal.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And we've carefully considered the thoughtful briefs filed by both sides, and we have the benefit of the record as well. So thank you both for your arguments.
Thank you.